This is Guy Bogart, your fellow cat lover. Having checked to see the cat's water dishes filled with clean, clear liquid, we can proceed to talk about them while they drink. If you're shopping for colored postcards, folks, those marked on the address side, photographed and distributed by Clara Faulkner, Hollywood, California. They're a series of natural color cards from Kodachrome prints, a Mike Roberts color production of Berkeley, California. I have quite a lot of cat cards in my files, but whether European or American productions, you won't find anything as lovely as these Clara Faulkner Kodachrome shots. And she is, like Walter Chandoa, that ideal combination, cat lover, artist, and photographic expert. She is one of the close supporters of the Los Angeles Cat Care Club, which is one of the finest feline institutions in the Southland. I wish I could describe the dozen samples of Mrs. Faulkner's art, kittens and grown cats of all breeds in charming natural poses. Ever try taking just ordinary snapshots of cats? And you know what I mean. Just remember that name and ask for it when you buy. You are getting less than the best if it isn't a Clara Faulkner product. She takes cat photographs and dog photographs both. If any of you want your kitty's picture done very specifically and specially, her address is 3350 Tirico Drive, Hollywood 28. If you can't remember, ask me and I'll tell you. I like passing along the good points of our circle of cat lovers. Thanks, Clara Faulkner, for your number one work, both in cat photography and in cat crusading. Another friend of Clara Faulkner's in such centers as the Cat Care Club is a former opera star, Miss Bernice Marchand, some of whose cat talks in the theater you heard 2 weeks ago. And here are four more of Miss Marchand's experiences in the theaters of Italy and America, where always the cat has her place. We read from her manuscript, quote, "I did a season of musical stock at Fontaine Ferry Park, Louisville, in the old days. We had a tenor whose voice was still lovely, but whose hair had left him desolate. He guarded the secret of his bald pate with his life. Even at rehearsals, he religiously wore a wig. However, we all recognized his skeleton. You can't fool an actor with a wig. But we went along with the camouflage, and on the stage in his war paint, he fooled the best of them. He was a nice chap and had shown some attentions to a stray cat which hung around the theater. The cat was in his room most every night. We realized she was about to become a mother, and all of us brought her scraps from time to time. During one particularly hot night, the tenor could stand that wig no longer. He tore it from his tortured scalp and left it on his makeup table to cool off. He slipped a towel over his head and went out of the stage door into the night air to take a smoke and search for a cool breeze. He stayed too long and suddenly realized he was hearing his cue music. Racing up to his dressing room, he frantically grabbed for the wig. To his dismay, he found three little kittens had just been born in it. The mother was taking them out one at a time and scrubbing them up. The wig was in no condition to be worn that night. His other one was locked in his trunk, and his music was calling. The tenor snatched a gay colored scarf from a costume, hastily wound it around his head, then clad in the last word of a summer suit, with his head wrapped up like a potentate, he dashed out onto the stage just in time to sing. That audience never knew what happened, why he had covered his beautiful blonde hair with that silly scarf. Maybe it was a joke, yes? And here's another little incident. At the Tech Theater in Buffalo, during a season of musical stock, our Sunday nights were our own, for some star-studded company was always brought in to give a Sunday night performance. Two well-known Shakespearean actors were to do Romeo and Juliet, and our company was practically commanded to attend en masse, much against our wishes. There was a lovely old black cat which had lived in the theater for years and raised countless families there, who was so well behaved that she had never been known to go on the stage while a performance was in progress. As soon as the show was over and the house lights came on, Madam X would pick her way carefully among the scene shifters and sit down in the middle of the stage. Madam X was about to grace the boards with another family and was not exactly svelte. She was that wide across the back. During Romeo and Juliet, all us lesser lights sat, slightly bored, I'll admit, clear to the death scene. The stage was dark and gloomy. A pale green light shone on Romeo's wan face. The theater was absolutely quiet, and Madam X must have thought the show was over, for at that exact moment she waddled out into the stage, unconscious of actors and audience. As she arrived at the heels of the kneeling, heartbroken Romeo, she stopped short. A sixth sense must have warned her all was not well. She sat down with her broad back toward the audience, looked up questioningly into Romeo's face, and said the loudest "Row!" I have ever heard. The unrestrained shout of laughter that went up from that audience rattled the rafters and, of course, ruined that death scene completely. And another incident. Years ago, in one of the smaller theaters of Italy, I was to sing Rigoletto. The baritone was a conceited, bombastic, talented young Italian who was said to be full of silly superstitions. I discovered that the gentleman always had a big, striped cat with him in his dressing room whenever he sang. I like cats, so I went in to see the mascot. He was lying on a trunk half asleep and perfectly relaxed. He submitted to my pettings, looking me over with half-closed eyes. I asked how the cat behaved while the opera was in progress, and to my surprise was shown a long string of garlic, which I was told could be attached to anything around the dressing room and would keep the cat busy playing until the opera was over. The baritone, to demonstrate his point, pinned the garlic to the tail of a garment hanging on a rack. The cat's eyes opened wide. He uncurled himself, crept toward the odoriferous string, and made a pass at it. The master said he would never sing an opera unless his mascot was there, that it always meant great success for him. I laughed and went about my own business. When the baritone made his entrance, there was a tremendous stir. An Italian audience, unlike us Americans, always listens for music. We are always ready to laugh, but I detected a slight snicker. Then I understood. The coat the baritone was wearing was the garment he had pinned the string of garlic onto. As he staggered around the stage, belching forth pear-shaped notes, the string of garlic waved behind him, and close behind the string came the cat, prancing and jumping and playfully swatting at the only plaything he knew. It is not recorded whether the baritone let his pet superstition die on the vine or thereafter restrained the cat from coming out during an opera performance. And finally, this one. In Baltimore, during a summer session of opera with DeWolf Hopper at the park, I was crossing some vacant lots on my way to rehearsal one morning when I met two little youngsters crying like their hearts would break. I stopped them and asked what on earth had happened. Between sobs, they told me their mother had made them take their kitten and throw it into the weeds. I asked them just where they had dropped it, and after walking for some distance through the tall weeds, we heard the cries of the little mite. It was just about the smallest kitten I ever saw. Its eyes were barely open, and it was very thin, but beautifully marked, Maltese and white. I picked the little waif, and it snuggled into my hands. I told the two kids, who loved the cat very much, that I would take it and find a good home for it, and not to worry or cry any more. They went away smiling. I carried that kitten back to my landlady and asked her to take care of it for me until I got through rehearsal. She put it in a big basement, fixed a bed, and left some milk. The little thing was much too young to feed itself, but it crawled into the bed and went to sleep. After rehearsal, I took the little baby up to my room and managed to get some warm milk down its throat from a spoon. It was so smart that after inspecting the box of sand, decided it was meant to be used and used it. When I went to the theater that night, I asked the girls in the chorus, they were all local youngsters, if any of them wanted a nice, clean, blue and white kitty that was beautifully marked and housebroken. One girl said she would love to have it, and they had a big yard, and they would take good care of it. After the performance, she drove to my room and took the little fellow away. I felt sure she would love him. From time to time, I inquired about the kitten. He was getting along beautifully, and they had named him after me, although he wasn't that kind of a cat. Then the season closed, and the incident was forgotten. 8 years later, I was playing in Baltimore with a production. A card was brought back to me one night with a woman's name on it, asking if she could see me. I did not recognize the good-looking young woman who walked into my dressing room. She asked me if I remembered giving a little kitten to one of the girls at the park years before. I did remember. She was the girl. I asked whatever became of the cat, and she said, "Would you like to see?" Being assured that I would, she went out to her car and returned with a handsome, well-mannered Maltese and white cat in her arms. He was so big, she could hardly lift him. His coat was like satin, and his face was beautiful. She said her whole family adored him, that he had helped raise her 3 children, and they wouldn't take anything in the world for him. He probably did not remember me, and I had all but forgotten him. But it was nice to know that I had been instrumental in making such a fine contribution to the cat world, unquote. Thanks for Miss Marchand's kindness. A little later, we shall have one more group of her opera experiences with the feline friends. To whom are we more indebted on these programs than my close friend, poet, and cat lover and artist, Lynn Hamilton? She sends this one from the Poetry Quarterly, Voices. I like the quaint conceit of Mary Owens Miller in her poem. Cats in Eden, you will ask? Well, it's an idea. Don't we expect cats in our experiences after death? I know many of you have written me to that effect, and like Michael Joseph, I wouldn't be much interested in the hereafter without cats. Anyway, I feel like you who have written on that score, so why not cats in Eden? Or it wouldn't have been an Eden. But we'll let the poet tell it. Faith is that of a child. Adam must have found comfort in cats, their gentle purrs, soft as silken linings of opening burrs, neat designs worked in their furs, catnip drunk or asleep on mats of violets or grass, or sleepily watching the angels pass. Adam must have watched new kittens shadow boxing or chasing mice, not catching, not killing, only their nice actions were known in that paradise. Claws were withdrawn into velvety mittens. He delighted in moons in amber eyes, full or dwindling crescent-wise, long before the original sin. Adam laughed at his kitten's innocent grin. Not a word of this in Holy Writ, but I've no doubt of it. That's from the pen of Mary Owings Miller. This is Guy Bogart with love and joy to you, one and all, as the lawyers phrase it, each and severally. Nighty night and happy purrs.